you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. If you're new to the Twilight Histories, this podcast is different than anything you've probably heard before. We tell stories where you are the main character. Think of it like a role-playing game where we're the dungeon masters and you're the hero. Or think of it like a video game like Skyrim or Assassin's Creed, where part of the fun is that you get to explore a new world. Here's the premise. It's the future. A machine has been invented that can split through the multiverse, allowing people to explore different worlds. Some of these worlds you'll find familiar. Others are totally exotic. But no world is exactly like our own. We will start off with a short 10-minute story to get you warmed up. This short was inspired by a suggestion made by one of our patrons, Brian Anderson. I call it The Frozen Earth. Enjoy. You run your gloved finger through the boiling liquid. It's thick like olive oil. You scoop it up into a pool in your hands and watch it boil into the vacuum of space before floating back as a mist to the churning sea around your boat. You look up at the moon, a dim crescent among the fireworks of stars. Next to the moon is another crescent, slightly smaller, more distant, and a stunning blue, the planet Neptune. You exhale, trying to release the tension in your chest. The timer on your wrist says you've been on the surface for over 60 hours. You are only supposed to be up for 4. You've long since finished your food tubes, but more importantly, your oxygen is running out. You look back at Earth's liquefied atmosphere, as you've done 1,000 times. There it is, an ocean of air, yet not a breath to breathe.
I can't take it anymore,
Feidao says. He rises, stops, then heads for the rail. Xia Jia grabs his leg. Stop your theatrics, she says. Come on, help me, she says to you. You rush over and grab Fei Dao around the waist.
Get off me, he says.
You're the only one who knows how the solar panels work. I'm not letting you jump off the boat.
I told you, the Earth stopped spinning. There's not enough sun. Please, our oxygen is almost out. Just let me die my own way.
You're in a suit, you fool. You'll float down to the bottom. It'll take you the same amount of time to die. You'd rather die down there in that liquid?
I want to die in our atmosphere.
I'm not letting you go. Fei Dao stops fighting. He sits down on the deck of the small fishing boat. I know you're upset, Xia Jia says. But we've got a chance. All we need is for the Earth to just turn a little. Just enough to poke over the horizon.
It's been 3 days. Neptune's gravity has messed it up. It's not going to happen.
But it might. We still have some oxygen.
The main tanks are empty. All we have is what's on our backs.
There has to be some way to fill them. We're on a sea of oxygen.
We've been over this before. There's no power without the solar panels. Without power, We can't run the generators, so we can't fill the tanks.
Then let's paddle.
Where? We're lost.
How about those islands over there?
You have enough strength to paddle?
We can't give up and die. Fine. You rest, and I'll paddle.
You turn off your radio. They've been fighting like this for days, ever since you discovered you were lost.
You lean over the edge and run your fingers through the liquid air while listening to the sound of your breathing.
How many more breaths will your tank give you? Will it hurt? Maybe if you sleep, it won't hurt. You'll just drift away.
The boat thunks to a stop, jarring you from a daydream. You leap to your feet. Shia Jia turns on her flashlight. After so long in the dark, the beam hurts your eyes. You turn on your radio. The two scavengers are in mid-fight.
Black hole, you fool, Shia Jia says.
No one knows that for sure. It could have been anything.
What else could have flung us out into space? Everyone knows it was a black hole.
Could have been anything. A gravitational anomaly.
What do you think a black hole is?
Yeah, but it could have been aliens for all we know.
Aliens. There it is. Finally comes out.
Would you two stop fighting for a moment, you say? Let's go and check out the island.
You jump off the boat and land waist deep in the boiling liquid atmosphere. Shia Jia and Fei Dao follow. The shore is thick ice. It's cracked and rough. The bowl of stars is interrupted by the dark slope of the island.
Let's get to the top and look around, Shia Jia says, and marches ahead of you.
You start to climb. You feel tired, and you notice you're wheezing a bit. You look at your gauge. It says your tank is nearly empty.
We should have topped up before we left the boat, you say to Fei Dao. It doesn't matter. There's nothing left in our reserve tanks. What we've got on our backs is all there is.
Are you two complaining again? Shia Jia says.
Not complaining. It's just information.
Not all information is equally important.
You think our tanks being empty isn't the most important thing to us right now?
No. I think getting to the top of the hill and looking around is much more important, so that's what I'm focusing on. Listen, my friend, these past 5 years since the Earth left its orbit have been terrible, and the most terrible years are yet to come. The Earth will leave the solar system and drift off into deep space. If humanity is to survive, we must adapt, and that means we must look for opportunities. Do you understand? For once, Fei Dao doesn't argue with her. He says nothing. His head is down. He's pushing on his knees to help him climb. You see the beam of Shia Jia's flashlight far ahead, bouncing up the side of the hill.
You are very smart, Fei Dao. Much smarter than me. I don't know the first thing about generators or solar panels. You rigged up the boat. You made these suits. Because of you, humanity is able to return to the surface. You are a true hero, Fei Dao. You are important, but you have to change the way you look at things. Do you understand? Am I getting through to you?
Shia Jia, I'm tired.
Okay, stay there. I'll go to the top and look around.
Fei Dao sits in the ice and slumps over. He gives you the sense of death. It scares you, but you stay with him. You're also tired.
Shanghai, Shia Jia says.
You see it?
Fei Dao says.
Yes, and more important, there's the sun. You see? You've got to think positively.
How much sun?
I can see it shining right through the buildings. It's a beautiful sight. It's perfect. Fei Dao, we can power your solar panels. We're saved.
I'm too tired, Fei Dao says.
All we have to do is row around the island. Oh, that beautiful sunrise. I've never seen a more beautiful sunrise in all my life.
Xie Jia is already leaping down the dark side of the hill.
I'm dying, Fei Dao says. My vision is going black.
Hang in there, I'm coming for you.
You see the beam of light bouncing down the hill towards you. Your oxygen is extremely low, and every breath is a struggle. But now you have hope. Hope has awakened something in you.
Xie Jia approaches. She helps Fei Dao up.
I can't, he says.
You go on the other side and help lift him. Together, you and Xie Jia carry him down the hill.
Hold in there. We'll take you down to the boat and get you a bit more oxygen.
I keep telling you, there's no more oxygen.
You're going to be fine, you hear me? But you remember what I said.
You and Xie Jia stumble your way through the dark to the boat. Xie Jia climbs up first and pulls Fei Dao up. You collapse into the liquid atmosphere in exhaustion.
You coming? Xie Jia says.
Give me a moment to catch my breath, you say.
Your head falls under the liquid. Your visor fills with millions of bubbles, tinted silver blue by Neptune and the moon. It's so hard to breathe. You wish you could take the hose and capture these bubbles. But of course, that's impossible. You pull yourself out of the liquid atmosphere and up onto the boat. You lie on the deck, exhausted, next to Fei Dao.
Where's Xie Jia, you say?
I don't know. I don't know where she found more oxygen, but she gave me some more. My tank has a little more in it.
Xie Jia, where are you?
Where is she?
She's not answering her radio.
Fei Dao leaps to his feet and runs around the boat. You hear him scream.
What is it?
You say, and pull yourself to your knees. Fei Dao doesn't say anything, but you can hear him breathing heavily through the radio.
What is it? Why did you scream?
With great effort, you walk around the boat. You see Fei Dao leaning next to something.
What is that?
It's Xie Jia's suit.
She couldn't have, you say.
She did. She must have given me the last of her oxygen, then jumped.
You stand there looking down at the boiling cauldron. Somewhere down there, in that mix of sub-zero liquid, nitrogen and oxygen, is Xie Jia's body.
What a way to die, you say.
She died for humanity,
Fei Dao says.
Now we have to live for humanity. Come on, let's row.
That was Frozen Earth, inspired by one of our patrons, Brian Anderson. In our last show, I asked our patrons to come up with an idea for a mini based on the word lost. We had about 20 submissions, and I went with this one. This is what Brian wrote for his original idea. You find yourself alone in a seedy part of an advanced civilization, locked in a glacier on a frozen earth. Now, I think what Brian came up with is perhaps more creative than what I did here. There's a lot more layers to Brian's idea, and a lot more world-building possibilities. And here's the thing. All the ideas I've seen from our patrons have really impressed me. My dream would be that instead of me pulling out just one of your ideas, we could have fans such as you building out your own ideas. We could have 10 or 20 concepts going at once.
Listen to just some of these ideas that our patrons have come up with. John Higgins wrote me with this idea of a werewolf hunting soldiers at Stalingrad. Now that is sticky. I can't get it out of my head. Mark and I came up with this idea. The Kaaba in Mecca is an ancient alien relic. It activates during a medieval Hajj, turning everyone into super soldiers. Here's one from Steve DeFalco. When going on vacation to a Renaissance-era world, you were told of the incredible markets, art, poetry, and lively public debates. When you arrive, you find it completely abandoned. We have a really creative fan base, and each of you has a different angle. Some of you are into hard alternate history. Others are more into wild fantasy or the science fiction side of things. And there's everything in between. I would love it if some of you stepped up and built out some of your ideas. So here's what I'm proposing. I'm creating a new podcast called Twilight Histories Extra. If you want to create something, that's the place for it to live. And I mean anything, really. It could be a recording from a role-playing campaign set in the Twilight Histories universe. Or it could be a story you write about splitting worlds, or even a fully realized audio drama with voice actors if you really want. This is your playground, where you get to create. If you find yourself getting more serious, I'm also offering to help coach you through Patreon. Together we can build you to the point where you can one day even join our team and get paid for your work. If any of this sparks joy, get in touch through Discord, Facebook, or Twitter. Maybe you could even team up with some of the other fans. If you want to do the coaching route, you can sign up through Patreon by selecting the tier called Writer's Guild. As for the next mini, your word of inspiration is fear. All patrons can add ideas, so come on over and add yours in Patreon. Go to the post called Fear. And now, or the main feature. Today's show is called The Big Turk and is written and produced by Tristan Verboven. Enjoy.
There is a gentle vibration throughout your body. The staleness of the air smells like some sort of ship. Your eyes open to a paneled ceiling, a retreating crescent pattern with the letters DHY. The heavy linen is monogrammed too, but there is no familiar sway of the sea. You wipe your eyes. The cabin is windowless with a small closet, a retractable chair, and compact washing facilities worked into the cramped space. There's a small photo and a metal frame of a dirigible docking at a skyscraper. To your uneasy delight, you are traveling in a Zeppelin. Your closet is laid out with the latest fashion. And in no time, you are ready to explore. A card at the edge of the mirror reads, "Breakfast is served in the gallery." A narrow passageway and then a spiral staircase. You clumsily catch the rail as the craft lists. At the top, in all its splendor, is a vast panorama seen through broad, slanted panel windows. Deep sea speckled with gray and green archipelago. You find a spot amongst the brushed aluminum tables, the sleek cantilever chairs in wicked mesh, surprisingly light but sturdy as you sit down. A waiter serves black coffee in a molded cup, delicately embossed in the crescent logo. And there's some reading material. Herald Tribune, Berliner Morgenpost, La Gazzetta del Sporto. Then you see the headline, Man of the Year, and settle on Time Magazine, June 1938. The cover is a strikingly handsome man in a trimmed mustache and fedora. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, President of the Turkish Republic. The lounge area is sleek and futuristic, even the ashtrays bear an aeronautical aesthetic, and travel advertising in Turkish motifs with modern compositions. Istanbul, bridge from east to west, ancient to modern, reads one. Another poster shows a chiseled profile watching a fleet of airships soaring by. Skies to the future, it reads. Behind you is a map, wall to wall with Istanbul in the center, rays shooting in every direction to the major cities of the world. Along the top are clocks marked by city, Istanbul in the center. Munching on a light breakfast of flatbread, olives, and honey in a packet, you flip through the pages of Atatürk in a variety of poses, on horseback, leaning out of a train, greeting adoring fans, giving speeches. In each he is impeccably dressed with dapper headwear. You read the article. The situation which gave rise to this populist demagogue is unusual for the Turkish character. A historically fractured society, forever held together by tradition, religion, and conservatism, now embraces the future. A nation once wholly foreign to innovation and liberalism is, in 6 short years, transformed. Turkey, the sick man of Europe, for centuries in the stagnant hands of religious cabal, has risen to the beacon of modernity. You casually flip to the next page and pick up the text at another spot. A product himself of the old establishment. His father worked middle management to a bloated Ottoman bureaucracy, leaving him unflappably middle class. Yet the dandy in him has formed a picture of the enlightened gentleman, the modern Turk, as a European, but also something greater. His reforms extend past the wardrobe. In these short years, he has driven out religious conservatives and replaced them with teachers, builders, and women. They are one of the first nations to grant women suffrage, and certainly not the last. Below is a picture of Atatürk with his wife, a small but comely woman with piercing eyes, sporting an elegant gown and headscarf. You flip ahead to the next page. Post-war Europe bears little resemblance to the past. Since the armistice of 1922, an exhausted Europe has learned from a war gone on too long that the old colonial powers are holding on for dear life to the dying flame of their former glory. They have overstayed their welcome, while their former foes have embraced the modern age. Atatürk finds himself part of a new league of nations, one part iconoclast, another part empirical. While Mussolini, Hitler, and Atatürk may not be formally allied, they share a charismatic ideology so in keeping with their times as to excuse, nay, embrace, their stoic pragmatism. The balance of power has settled on the echoes of a classic triumvirate, Rome, Byzantium, and the Kingdom of the Goths. You're interrupted by a loudspeaker message.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the starboard gallery, we can now see the Bosphorus Strait and the Dardanelles. We shall be making our final approach to Istanbul Center.
The diner is now busy. A man and his young daughter ask to share your table, so you fold away your magazine and invite them to sit. The girl pulls up a chair and immediately opens a picture book from her bag. The title reads, Stories About Atatürk for Children. She sees you eyeing her book. Atatürk has the world's biggest collection of hats, she says smartly. We are going to see them at the World Fair. Are you going too? Everyone in the Zeppelin is going. You nod politely and look over to her father, who smiles his approval. Tell me a story about him, you reply in a friendly voice. She opens to a chapter called The Motor Car and points to the illustration. A young man in officer's uniform on horseback, surrounded by dark, shrouded warriors. This is when he was just called Captain Mustafa Kemal, she says. He was a brave leader who had an army of African horsemen and rode them into battle against a great empire and chased them into the sea. She turns the page. And here he is as a general leading his men against another great invading empire from the sea. Oh, that's right down there. You point out the window to the coastline below. Well, they're not there anymore, she says, eyes wide. Ataturk sent them away for good. He certainly did, you chuckle. She turns the page again. After his victory, a general came all the way from Germany to meet him. The German general had also had a great victory. He arrived at the border, driven in a motor car, something Ataturk had never seen before. The German general has a fabulous mustache, and in contrast to General Ataturk, he's wearing fancy regalia, a saber, and a ridiculous furry hat with skull and crossbones on the front.
I wish to build a railroad, the German announced. That will connect east from west,
the little girl says, holding her finger dramatically in the air. But Ataturk was not listening. He is way more interested in the car. It does look pretty fancy, you play along. Then the general said, if you like this car, you can keep it. Ataturk was very happy and got in the car right away.
I cannot drive it anymore, says the general. My friend the Archduke died in this car. It's bad luck.
Ataturk did not believe in superstition.
Anyway, I prefer to ride a horse, the German general said.
She turns another page. The car is drumming up dust, and a fez is flying through the air. Ataturk left the German general and went for a ride through the town in his new motor car. As the driver started going faster, the wind blew off his fez. But Ataturk was having so much fun he let it go. Instead of asking the driver to stop, he pointed to the driver's floppy hat. Let me wear yours, he said. And from then on, he went everywhere in his motor car. What a great story, you chuckle. There's more if you want to hear another one, she says excitedly. And before you can reply, she opens the book to the next chapter. The Man in the Strange Hat. Many years later, when Ataturk became president of the country, he still loved hats a lot. He used to drive his motor car around the country, teaching children how to read and giving new hats to his people. In the illustration, he's tossing hats from the car, and people are throwing away their fezes and trying them on. One day, he was driving in Mesopotamia, between the two great rivers, when he saw a man very far away, all alone in the desert, wearing a strange hat that he had never seen before. The illustration shows Ataturk speaking to a small man in an enormous beige helmet. He drove off the road to meet him. Why are you out here in the sun? Asked Ataturk. I'm looking for oil, said the man. Oil? Said Ataturk. Tell me where it is, and I will buy that hat from you. Name your price. So, the man showed him where all the oil was, and left with a bare head and a pocket full of gold. That is a pretty funny hat, you reply. That hat is in the collection at the World Fair in Ankara, she says proudly, and lots of hats from all over the world. A message comes on announcing your landing in 10 minutes. You excuse yourself graciously. Thank you for your great stories, you say, tipping your hat to the girl's father. Don't you want to hear about Ataturk and Albert Einstein? The girl protests. Maybe another time, you reply. The craft is now casting a shadow over Constantinople. You can hear the sound of the city, and the crowds gathering below. You can see the great fortifications and the magnificent Hagia Sophia, a skyline of mosques, and Topkapi Palace. The ship is slowing to dock at a tower across the Golden Horn, and voices shout as they lower the ropes. The attendant is motioning you to go ahead, despite bearing a trunk, so you scurry to the lower decks. Outside in the wind, The crew is lowering the gangplank to the docking station. A woman next to you with a camera lines up the perfect shot, clicks away and looks over to you. "Are you with the press corps?" she says. "I don't think I've seen you before." She pulls off her glove. "Margaret Bourke-White. Nice to meet you." "I think we might be safer off this thing than on it," she chuckles, throwing her camera strap over her shoulder. You descend the narrow cage, and then there's a stairwell. And when you get to the line at customs, you sneak in with the photographer who you just met, who's speaking with a portly man in spectacles. "Meet Rafi Reynolds from the Daily Mail," she says to you. "He's our man in Berlin. Ever since that interview with Adolf Hitler, they've got me covering every tinpot upstart, hoping for another scoop." He shakes your hand. "Welcome to the press corps." He hands you the itinerary, lowering his glasses to read it. "Says here, our luggage will be sent through to the station to make sure we get the last ferry to Haydar Pasha for the high-speed Wagon Lee to Ankara. Tomorrow we'll get to see the Big Turk himself." Once through the gates, you step out into the busy streets. At first glance, everything looks pretty European, right down to the streetcar clanging through the crowd. Margaret sees your expression. "This is the European part of town," she says. "All the good stuff's over there across the Golden Horn." You go off by yourself down the promenade to a funicular that brings you to the Galata Bridge. You take in the street life. Food vendors, shoe shiners, barbers, and animals all share the narrow space between the road and the water. People are very smartly dressed. Every man, whatever his walk of life, has on a jacket and a tie and a wide variety of hats. And the women on their arms are in modest but elegant frocks. The top side of the floating bridge is noisy with vehicles. Below is busy with pedestrians. The edge, a blur of fishing poles. The constant frenzy leaves you no time to collect your thoughts, so you wander deeper, making your way into the Egyptian spice market. You hit all the tourist spots. Topkapi Palace, the Hagia Sophia, Hippodrome. You get a sense of how ancient it all is. Looking at the street vendors and horses and streetcars, you wonder how little and how much has changed since the emperors and the sultans. Even they must have marveled at how old and how new everything was. At the covered bazaar, you choose a quaint corner tea house. Sipping chai from an hourglass cup, you indulge in people watching. The market sells jewelry, carpets, radios, cameras, and souvenirs from a cramped arcade. Three older men at the next table are taking in the same world as you. Similar, yet different. All of them are wearing headscarves, yet each in his own way. All of them have a mustache, each trimmed in its own way, and each of them clicks a string of beads in his fingers, in his own way. Taken by this whimsical observation, you remember that you're a reporter and jot down some of these details in a notebook. "Fancy meeting you here, stranger!" Margaret's familiar voice rings out, and Rothai follows with a carpet rolled up under his arm. "I picked this up for a bargain," he says proudly. "Well, there's a sucker born every minute in this place," interjects Margaret, rolling her eyes. She has her hands on her hips, blonde hair flowing to the side, dressed as if she's on a safari, khaki pleated pants and baggy blouse with suspenders, even high black riding boots. The men at the next table stare at her without speaking, so she throws her eyes their way for a moment until the old men look away, and then cracks a smile in your direction. "Well, you got the right idea." She holds your gaze for a moment, grinning, then looking you up and down, raising her camera. "Hold still, I want to capture you in your moment." "Hold on," Rothai jumps in. taking a flower from his buttonhole. He hands it to you, and once you have it firmly in your lapel, Margaret snaps away.
"We would join you," says Rothai, "but I've got this monstrosity." "Well, why don't I join you?" you reply. And off you go, the three of you, Rothai and Margaret making a scene as they walk. Rothai is no worse for wear, hauling his roll through the ancient streets. So you meander downward to the old port. Margaret points to the many portraits of Ataturk mounted on every wall. "I can see why they call him the Big Turk. I mean, even Gary Cooper doesn't get this kind of press." The Big Turk is what we call him, dear," says Rothai. "Here he's the father of Turks." "Well, I bet he doesn't mind being called either one. Well, maybe you can ask him yourself at the gala tomorrow in Ankara. Although I hear that, for a man of the people, getting access to him is positively Diocletian." "Well, he sure likes his picture taken," she muses. "Should be easier to get a good shot." You arrive at the water and are about to cross the Galata Bridge when Margaret draws you over to a fish fry near the docks, pulling you through a storm of pigeons. The three of you eat balik ekmek from a folded newspaper, with no utensils but the flatbread, sitting on Rothai's rolled-up carpet watching the ships and ferries docking in the ancient port, seagulls swooping down to steal fish from the incoming boats.
"Let's get on that ferry, then." Rothai wipes his mouth with his handkerchief. "We've got a train to catch."
Leading over the bow, you watch the station inch closer. Under the glow of spotlights, it is a neoclassical block left over from the Ottoman days. You dock at the steps by the front entrance under a giant clock. Inside the terminal, the arches and vaulting are adorned with tribal designs.
"Welcome to Asia,"
laughs Margaret, snapping a picture of the archways. Rothai is fumbling through the itinerary.
"Don't we have tickets?"
you ask, confused.
"We're on a special train for delegates and press corps," he replies. "The Ankara Express. They say it's the fastest train in Asia and the most luxurious. Compliments of the Big Turk."
The departure board goes clickety-clack. The top position reads, "Ankara Express, Schlafwagen. Charter reservations only. Boarding track 2.
"Let's meet up at the bar car once we've all settled in," says Rothai.
And down the narrow corridor, you land on the door with your name. The room is compact but comfortable. The bench folds into a bed. There are washing facilities under a countertop, and your suitcase has been set up in the closet. You sit down for a moment to take it all in. The attendant is escorting a passenger to the adjacent room, and you hear the door click shut and the closet opening and closing. The whistle blows and the train goes from jolted slow roll to a gradual pace until before long you are speeding into the night. The acceleration is quite frightful. So you close the window and settle into a pamphlet about the Ankara World Fair. There are exhibits on culture, technology, and pavilions from a dozen countries. Just as you're glancing at photos of hyper-modern constructions, you hear people headed down to the rear of the train, so you try to get there before it gets too busy. The corridor is louder than your room, and every time a train passes the other way, the blast makes the car go dark. Railing from car to car. At the dining lounge, you spot your friends at a table with a mustachioed man at the window in an impeccable bow tie. Rothai points at the seat across from him. The table is laid out with small oval trays of bread, olives, and some tiny crimson peppers.
"Having sampled just about every kind of German schnapps," says Rothai, pouring out a glass for you, "I could tell you that this Serbian brandy is the deadliest I've seen."
You shuffle in and take the shot. Instantly, a burning sensation smolders in your gut.
"This is Ali Saip," says Margaret. "He's a Kurd from Kurdistan. Did you even know there was such a place as Kurdistan?"
The man nods politely, taking a long draw of his cigarette. Margaret and Rothai have clearly already been at that bottle of Slivovitz and start talking shop, mostly gossiping about other journalists and their indiscretions.
"So there I was, and stuck in an elevator with Kim Philby," Rothai chuckles.
Ali Saip drinks his coffee, not touching the hard stuff at all, not even bothering to try to get a word in. Before long, Margaret taps you on the shoulder.
"Gentlemen, I'm going to head in."
She scoots over as you stand up to let her out.
"I'll walk you back, dear,"
says Rothai, chummeling.
"Oh, thank you, darling," she says, saying goodbye. "I'm right in the middle of God's little acre, and I just can't put it down."
Her voice fades away into the noisy car. And you are left alone in silence with the mysterious Kurd. You pop one of the tiny red peppers in your mouth as the man smiles.
"Afiyet olsun."
The dizzying burn causes your eyes to water and your face to flush. And the man chooses this moment to break the awkward silence.
"It must be very difficult to be journalist," he says flatly.
You point helplessly at your mouth.
"Of course," he continues in a steady, intense voice. "It is very important job."
You try to quench the burn with another shot of brandy, only intensifying the sensation.
"Most people," he continues, "they live in their own world. They see their own things. But you, a journalist, you see a different world."
He pauses to take another long draw, then stubbing out his cigarette.
"You see things they cannot see."
You recover for a moment to respond. "It's a very interesting job, that's for sure."
"That is why it is so important to be careful what you see."
Continuing in his very flat tone.
"Or what you think you see."
"It certainly is a big responsibility," you reply, awkwardly.
"You will be shown a lot of things," he says. "You will see a lot of things. And you will see things even you are not shown."
He pauses, smiling.
"So, be careful what you see."
Your head finally starts to clear. "Thank you for the advice," you say, wiping your forehead. "Please, excuse me." You get up and make your way back to your room. You travel the rows of doors with your hand before you, ready to catch a handrail as the train sways. You are nearly at your door when the train buckles with the force of a passing train. Plunge into darkness, and fumbling for the door handle, you fall into the room. The lights come back on, and you immediately see, on the floor, a pair of unfamiliar shoes and a leather satchel that has fallen over, the hilt of a revolver showing in the flap. In that fraction of a second, you quickly back up out the door, closing it firmly. A door slides open from the next car down the corridor, and you quickly slip into your room. Your bed has already been made while you were out. You sit down to catch your breath. Sure enough, the footsteps down the corridor stop at the next room. And over the sound of your pounding heart, they stop for a moment at the door. Then slowly enter, door creaking. There's some shuffling and moving. And slowly the noises settle to silence. Lay in your bed. You play that flash moment in your mind to the sound of the tracks thumping. You can see it clearly. Those shoes. Two-tone leather with tasseled laces. The satchel, fine brown with slight wear around the buckles. The revolver. You saw just the handle, but it had that distinct ring suspended from the grip. And what do you do with this fact? Tell someone? Who would you tell? Maybe you should take the advice of the man in the dining car and be careful what you see. You roll over into the heavy linen sheets and the hard, thin pillow of your bunk and let yourself be lulled to sleep by the steady pulse of the rails. You have breakfast alone in your room. The early sun is warming the dew over the Anatolian plain. Thick black coffee with sweet pastries and juice from a sealed pouch poured into a monogrammed glass. The scenery goes from rolling prairie to hilltop towns to shanty towns, speckled with the occasional mosque. You can tell that you're approaching the city by the giant billboard, seemingly trying to black out the slums and construction sites. "Science and reason," reads one of them, Ataturk in a classroom. "Youth with wings ensure our future," Ataturk, saluting young female pilots. "Sovereignty is taken, not given," Ataturk, marching with his soldiers. "Is there anything he can't do?" you ask yourself, chuckling. An announcement comes on.
"Arrival in Terminus Ankaragar. In a few moments, please prepare to disembark. Welcome to Ankara, home of the 1938 World Fair."
The rolling hills have given way to thick urban sprawl. Grand boulevards, streetcars and automobiles, skyscrapers with clean, elegant lines. The train creeps into a glass and steel enclosure. The engine shuts down and passengers come to life. The attendant bursts in, bringing in with him the noisy corridor.
"Please leave your luggage, sir."
You step off the train and follow the procession through the main terminal to the entrance of the metro system. At the bottom of an escalator, a very clean train is waiting. The platform has a mosaic honoring the tunnel workers. The train car has simple leather-bound seats and chrome handles. The ads are posters featuring stylized representations of the nations in the World Fair. France is a silhouette of the Eiffel Tower. The USA is the Empire State Building. Italy is a picture of the Colosseum. Before long, the train arrives at Kizilai Station. This platform has modern domed ceilings. A wide stairway leads into the morning sun. The top is a vast square of marble flanked by columns with stylish frieze impediment. The head of the square is a rectangular Roman structure. Without any of the classical flourish, it distinguishes itself by its brutal simplicity. Atop each column is a Turkish flag. Below, a guard in ceremonial uniform and white helmet. And above the structure is an enormous red crescent, casting a shadow on the marble below. People are migrating through the entrance to what you are now reading in your guide is the International Exhibition. A superb indoor space illuminated by a ceiling of glass panels held up with steel engineering. The French Pavilion features works of art, the Bayeux Tapestry, some 18th century paintings, sculpture by Rodin, finishing off with the Impressionists and Cubists. Next is the USSR. A red star in bas-relief holds over the proletariat in comfort. Visitors freely walk around a worker's dwelling, a modest apartment complete with modern convenience, efficient use of space, and electrical innovations. The Italian Pavilion is devoted to ancient Rome, along with several artifacts. An entire wall is dedicated to emperors, culminating in the profile of a hard-jawed Mussolini. For lunch, you settle on a Finnish concoction of reindeer meat and hearty salmon casserole, and for dessert, an ice cream cone served by a robot at the American Diner. Sure enough, Margaret and Rothai saunter over. "Do you know how long it's been since I've had a proper fish and chips?" he says, launching into a paper sack. "We just came from the Canadian exhibit," says Margaret. "They actually serve real maple syrup." "We mustn't forget, though," says Rothai, munching on a chip. "This afternoon is the press conference with the Big Turk himself." "We're headed there right now," says Margaret. "You should join us." In the conference hall, a band is playing Turkish jazz. Waiters are keeping the drinks flowing, and the press corps is clustered throughout the room, waiting for a sighting of the man himself. A microphone is flanked with white-helmeted guards. Suddenly, the music stops, and a man gently taps the microphone.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I present the President of the Turkish Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk."
The excitement grows as the room bursts into applause. There's a sudden migration towards the podium. You stay put as the crowd surges forward, leaving the back of the room quite empty. You notice the man you had met the night before in the dining car. You raise your hand to wave hello, but then you stop yourself. That bag that he's holding, distinct leather buckles, his feet. There's no mistaking those shoes. Atatürk takes the podium. The man reaches into his satchel, and just as the hilt is visible, you lunge forward to grab it from him. Surprised by a hand on his wrist, he hangs back. Shots are fired into the ceiling. Screams immediately call out, and the room falls into pandemonium. You fall down on top of the man. The guards are on him in a flash, pushing them through with their rifles. Atatürk is swiftly drawn away. Guards violently restrain you as the man is dragged to his feet in handcuffs. For a moment, you are face to face.
"You!"
he sneers before he is dragged away. Several people around you congratulate you heartily, shaking your hand and patting you on the back. An officer breaks up the circle and asks you to accompany him, while the MC comes back to the podium.
"Ladies and gentlemen, this press conference will resume at another time. Please, allow the officers to secure the premises."
You are whisked away to a room and questioned. You tell the story the best you can. Your meeting in the diner, your chance encounter in the train car. You spend hours in the room. until you are escorted to a luxury automobile where you sit alone. The guard and the driver take a forward compartment. The ride offers an impressive view of the city, paved streets, modern shopping centers, and a dazzling show of city lights. The police escort weaves up a winding road into the suburbs, and then through a gate, the car pulls up in front of a beautiful Bauhaus-style mansion. It is flat-roofed, symmetrical, with a colonnade of arches leading to a solid metal door with a medallion in the center. The impressive hall is lined with extraordinary tapestries on marble. Another metal door opens into a living space with modern furniture and elegant artwork. The guard nods to you, leaving you standing in the middle of the room. The far balcony looks out onto the skyline. Each section of the wall features abstract Turkish motifs. One of the walls has framed photographs, so you are immediately drawn. Ataturk with Charlie Chaplin. Ataturk with Albert Einstein. Ataturk in uniform with his troops. And you fall upon a modest old photo of him seated with a woman next to him in a black smock and headscarf. "That was when we first met," says a voice behind you. You turn around and see the same woman, much older, wearing a bright, elegant yellow dress and intricate long silver necklace. "He was billeted at my father's house, who was the mayor of Izmir." She looks at her husband next to her. "Although I did not like him at first." Ataturk steps forward, offering his hand. "My wife, Latif, and I would like to thank you for your heroism," he says graciously, "if you will be a guest in our home." "Thank you," you reply, "and what a nice home it is." "This house was designed by Turkey's greatest architect, Sifri Arkan," he announces, offering you a seat at a cluster of comfortable, futuristic armchairs by the window. "He was schooled in Germany and is an example of a new generation of visionaries shaping our world." An attendant brings some tea in a stylish service, a mix of traditional patterns in metal. "Would you like a drink?" he says. "He can bring you alcohol if you like, but I don't touch it myself." He looks at Latif, taking her hand. "Not for any religious reasons, believe me." "He gave it up years ago," she says solemnly, "after a rather embarrassing incident." "Now, now," says Ataturk. "Suffice to say, it is bad for my health." He sips his tea. "We are all better off now. My husband is now devoted to his country and his wife." "Your accomplishments are impressive," you reply. "But not mine alone," he says. "We have always been a great nation. Under Rome, we were always the richer. While the world was in the Dark Ages, we were the greatest nation on earth. The Ottomans ruled for centuries. We needed only to modernize." "Turkey needed something more than just old religious men," interjects Latif. "And now it is the young people who teach the old." "She makes it sound so easy," laughs Ataturk. "But as you can see, not everyone is happy with this new world." You spend the rest of the evening with your illustrious hosts, as they show you around the grounds, their collection of artwork. Later, while you and Ataturk are standing again before the collection of photographs, Ataturk has a moment of sentimental yearning. He points to an old picture of him as a young officer, surrounded by Berber horsemen. "It has been many years since the Great War," he sighs. "They say it was the war to end all wars, but I am not so sure." He looks at you with a deep gaze. "Europe's quarrels were exhausted, but not resolved.
and the broken men who survive. Now they lead nations into the modern age, with power beyond their dreams.
He points to the picture of him shaking hands with Mussolini.
It's only a matter of time, he says in a tired voice, before old disputes must be fought again.
He shows you an old map of Ottoman Libya.
The army I raised 25 years ago to fight Italian imperialism, they still fight them today. Rome has never settled beyond the range of their navy guns.
Imagine what my Berber hussars could do with modern guns.
He keeps his gaze on the map while you look at the curious objects on display. You fall upon a small brass handle sitting alone on the shelf.
Interesting that you draw to this piece, he says, picking it up. That is the gear shift from a 1910 Graf und Stift double phaeton. That was my first automobile.
I hear that it was the very car the Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in, you say.
Yes, the corset car from Sarajevo, he laughs. On that day, the driver took a wrong turn, and when he had difficulty changing gears, the assassin took a shot.
He squeezes the handle in his grip.
If only a hero could stop his hand.
He gives you a bittersweet grin.
Or if the gear shift, maybe it function. Perhaps there could have been no great war, and maybe even no Turkish nation.
He takes your hand and presses the brass knob into it.
That is why I want you to have it. A gift of thank you for your heroism.
You weigh the handle for a moment in your hand, looking into its brassy sheen, and you thank the president for such a personal memento.
If you will excuse me, I must see my wife.
Ataturk gives you a warm goodbye, walking you to the car outside. The cavalcade serpentines down the hill and deposits you at the Hotel Cumhuriyeti in Kizilay, where you are given the presidential suite. The next days are spent visiting the World Fair. As promised, you see Ataturk's extraordinary collection of hats, including the funny yellow helmet, then a display of the latest Turkish automobiles, including the car from Sarajevo itself. Sure enough, you notice the gear shift handle is missing. On the final day, you see a superb military march, followed by a parade of musicians and performers from throughout Turkey. The evening, before leaving, you say goodbye to Margaret and Ratay.
Congratulations on a smashing scoop, old boy, he says, slapping her arm. That piece you wrote about meeting with Ataturk might just win you the Pulitzer this year. And remember that photo I took of you at the covered market, says Margaret proudly. It might just make the cover of Life magazine.
It has been quite a productive trip, you say humbly. As you are waiting to board the enormous airship, you notice the people around you staring and pointing. Once you're settled into your cabin and the craft has been launched, you step into the lounge again to take in the spectacular view. As you enjoy the passing Aegean, you notice the clever little girl who had told you those stories on the flight in, and tipping your hat to her father, you slip into the seat next to her. Thank you again for telling me those stories, you say to her. I asked Ataturk myself, and he said all of them were true.
Of course they were true, she giggles.
Did you enjoy the fair, you ask.
Yes, she smiled. I can't wait to tell my friends at school.
You take out the brass handle from your pocket. You should show them this, you reply, handing it to her. That is the gear shift handle of the car from Sarajevo. Ataturk gave it to me.
The 1910 Graf und Stift double phaeton, she marvels.
It's yours now, you say, getting up. Show it to your friends. You plop your hat back on your head. Nodding a goodbye to your stunned friend and her father, you walk back to your cabin. The craft slowly rises into the night sky. You will never find out what course is set, for this is the end of your adventure. What could top it? A front row seat to the greatest show on earth? A private audience with the Big Turk himself? And a chance to change the very course of history? Although, it's not real history, though it did seem like real history at the time. But there are other times to visit, other adventures to have, other people to see. We must let this world and its modern age be.
That was The Big Turk by Tristan Verboven. If you enjoyed this show, please consider becoming a patron. Patreon is how we support our team to continue creating great shows like the one you heard today. Not only can you get a huge backlog of content only available to patrons, but you can also get new shows before they're released. And you can even submit your ideas to the minis I produce at the beginning of the shows, like Frozen Earth. I'm trying to get as many patrons as possible the chance to hear their ideas fully produced into an audio adventure. So please, come on down to Patreon. If you feel the urge to create Twilight Histories content, there's an opportunity for you to do this in a soon-to-be-released podcast, Twilight Histories Extra. Audio dramas, stories, role-playing games set in the Twilight Histories universe, your own alternate histories explained. This is your podcast, and I want your content. To get involved, the best place is through Discord, and you can also contact the Twilight Histories on Facebook, Twitter, and Patreon. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care.